Welcome back to The Wildlife Explorer, a podcast by Essex Wildlife Trust where we aim to inspire a lifelong love of nature. Now, I don't know about you, but I've absolutely loved watching the BBC Wild Isles documentary by Silverback Films. It showcased the wildlife we have in the UK, the very real problems they face, and the actions we can all take to help. So this is going to be a Wild Isles special, and we have a fantastic guest coming on to tell us what it was like to create this series. But first, here's a clip from the show to get us started.
Welcome to a place that is astonishing. Nature in these islands, if you know where to look, can be extraordinary. Dramatic and beautiful. It rivals anything I've seen elsewhere. It's not far. It's home.
I'm joined here today by Hilary Jeffkins from Silverback Films, who was a series producer in the Wild Isles documentary featuring Sir David Attenborough. Thank you so much for coming on today. It's really lovely to have this opportunity to speak with you.
Pleasure.
Can you tell me a bit about your role in the making of the documentary?
So I had two roles, really. My first was I was a producer. So I produced the first programme called Precious Isles. Also, I was a series producer across the series. So I was looking across all the programmes.
Oh, brilliant. How on earth do you go about getting into that as a career? It sounds like a dream job, to be honest.
I've been at it for many years. So I guess as a child, I started off being really curious about insects and flowers and things. My mum was a keen gardener. So I used to collect lots of bugs and wonder what they were doing. And from that, I studied biology. So did a degree in biology. And then was lucky enough to get a job at the Natural History Unit at the BBC in Bristol. So I spent 25 years there making wildlife documentaries. So that was my journey in, really.
Oh, fabulous. And this particular documentary is a bit different in that a lot of other nature documentaries take place overseas, whereas this one was placed in Britain. What made you decide to showcase the wildlife that we have in the UK?
I think over my years of working in natural history, I did a lot of British programmes and live British outside broadcasts, and just noticed how spectacular and interesting the biology and the animals were in Britain. So working with Alistair Fothergill, who runs Silverback Films, he was always keen, his dream was to make a British programme and do it properly, do it like you might film a foreign programme. So for many years, every time he pushed to try and get a commission, he'd always take along his British idea and say, what about this one? And it was quite hard to get the finance and get the interest in it. So there was always a passion and desire to do it. And the BBC accepted it and commissioned it in 2017. So, yeah, it was a dream come true, really.
And I think it's safe to say you pulled it off. The footage you got is absolutely breathtaking, it's beautiful, and everyone at the Essex Wildlife Trust was so excited for every Sunday to tune in for the next instalment. I wanted to ask you, what is the sort of sequence or footage that you're most proud of?
It's hard to say, there's so many things. I really enjoy the macro sequences. So we filmed a sequence about arum in a woodland. I know it sounds like a small, tiny plant, but actually telling the story inside a plant and getting that macro footage and just seeing the insects and seeing the whole behaviour story. So I was really proud of that one. And filming the orca, it's amazing to bring to people such a big predator and to excite people about an animal that's in our seas that many people are quite surprised to see. And that was quite a challenge filming that and quite a dramatic sequence, which I felt was, as we all felt, was as good as anything that you might see abroad. And you do see in the other blue chip programmes, orca hunting, and it's really lovely, and I'm very proud that we have that in our own British waters.
I do think with the macro photography, it tells a story that
we just would never be able to have the insight into with our own, obviously, human eyes. And even things like your time lapses, it just gave a whole new life and perspective on things like the starfish, where it was a whole sequence where it was getting its prey and things. And as for Orca, I think a lot of people are quite surprised to find out we even have them in the UK. So that was fabulous footage. But in what might be minutes of footage within the actual programme, that can take weeks to get, can't it? In your efforts, and obviously I imagine you do a lot of research within this, did you learn anything new about the species that you were capturing?
We did. We tried to ask ourselves questions when we were planning a sequence. So any behaviour that we were filming, we wanted to see if there was anything new or anything beyond what had been seen before. So there was a combination of being very curious and, for example, how could we film inside an ant's nest? What happens with starlings when darkness comes? So we were lucky enough to be able to apply technology like thermal cameras to see what happened beyond the norm. And so, for example, with the starlings, when they roost, everybody thinks they're quite safe in their roost, but there was a lot of activity going on. So our cameras enabled us to see quite new behaviour that we saw barn owls coming in and hunting and taking the starlings out of the roost. So that was very new. And certainly with when we filmed adders, sometimes it's just spending more time there. So scientists have their routines and they spend as much time as they can. But if you spend a couple of weeks watching, you do see new things. And the mating behaviour of the adders was quite extraordinary. And we saw the sort of physiology of the male more clearly with a barbed penis and that kind of gentle courtship behaviour where the male was tapping the female's butt back with his head, which the scientist said was he hadn't really seen. So we were lucky enough to be able to then share that footage with the academics so that they can look in more detail as well.
It was actually quite phenomenal, the adder footage, because, like you say, they have a barbed penis, so they're locked in, and she literally drags him along behind her, doesn't she, and having to fend off other males in the process. That was quite an eye-opener, to say the least. There are some stomach-churning scenes, aren't there, throughout the series. The one that I think stood out in my mind was the giant leech and how it just slowly swallowed the tiny toadlet. And obviously you've got some high-impact, incredible chase footage as well. When you're filming it, I mean, as the viewer, we're just on the edge of our seats. But as you're filming those scenes, do you find yourself immersed in all the action?
Absolutely, and certainly with the leeches and the toadlets, it was a very sort of specific situation. We had to find a pond where the toadlets were just at that stage when they were migrating out, and a pond that had the leeches. And you're set back from it, really. You just watch the action as it happens. There's not much you can do. And my children would say to me, "Why didn't you save him?" Well, you can't really. You just have to let nature take its toll, really. And seeing it on a monitor with a macro lens, you know, if you're looking with your eyes looking down at a pond, you see it, but seeing it in that detail is quite extraordinary. So you do get drawn in, and it is quite a drama, really. Certainly with some of the hunts that you mentioned, white-tailed eagles hunting geese, it is quite extraordinary. It happens so fast sometimes that, you know, the cameramen are on it and then it's over and you play it back. And sometimes it's when you play it back, you see that detail and that awe.
Definitely. And I think one thing that makes those moments as well has to be the music, because it really just adds, you know, it can make something seem like, with the Great Crested Grebes, it made it seem like a whole ballet performance, or with chase footage, it feels like a horror scene or action thriller, doesn't it? So it does, I think, really make those moments. And I read the Wild Owls book, that is a great accompaniment for anyone that's interested in the series. And within it, you had a really great quote by naturalist John Muir, and I'm going to read it just so I don't butcher it. He said, when one tugs at a single thing in nature, he finds it is attached to the rest of the world. Did it strike you when filming just how interconnected everything is?
Definitely, and it's such a brilliant quote, actually, because in ecosystems, everything is connected. You know, the habitat, the food chains, so it all has to work. And if there's something happens to one of those parts, you know, it does unravel. And I think there were some times when we were struggling to film, we were wondering what it was, what part of that thread had been tugged and wasn't working. And for example, with mayflies, which we filmed in freshwater rivers, the timing of that had changed, and that was because the climate was different. So there wasn't a large emergence anymore. There were smaller emergencies happening because the weather was sporadic. So that was one of those, and something that was affecting it. And down to the rivers being polluted, if you've got sediment on the rocks and stones in the bottom of the rivers, the mayfly larva can't survive and breed. And they then can't hatch, and they then can't emerge in mass and feed other creatures that are waiting. So there is a whole string and cycle that needs to be kept in balance. And if you lose a part of it, that's when you start to lose habitats and lose species.
And one obviously major impact we're having on things like mayflies, which obviously then interrupts the whole ecosystem, fish and beyond, is us putting sewage and pollution into the rivers. And I wanted to ask, when filming, was it quite an eye-opener of the very real impacts that humans are having on wildlife?
Certainly with rivers, we did notice that a lot of them are quite dead. So it's a bit of a dilemma. We're looking for those beautiful, pristine rivers, and those are the ones that have banded damoiselles and kingfishers. So in some ways, we're not telling a true story because we're picking the very best. But we do mention in our commentaries the state of these rivers. But yeah, you know, we do notice that.
Yeah. One of my, on a bit more of a cheerful note, one of my favourite sequences that you have is the large blue butterfly, because I never knew before about their just fascinating life cycle. It's just so intelligent, isn't it, how they've evolved that behaviour. And I wanted to ask, can you tell us a bit about that for anyone that might not have seen it? And how on earth did you go about capturing that footage, like you said, inside an ant's nest?
Well, that's an incredible behaviour, and that can relate back to pulling that string and needing to have all the parts and components to survive. So I think in the 1970s, large blue butterflies were disappearing, and they wondered why. So a young scientist then called Jeremy Thomas was charged to sort of look into what it was about their life cycle that was disrupted. And hence the amazing story of their life cycle unravelled. So they need chalk meadows, and they need wild thyme. So these are all the sort of stepping stones. So a large blue butterfly will lay its egg on a thyme plant, and then the egg will hatch out and develop into a caterpillar. And when the caterpillar grows a little bit, it plays a trick. It needs red ants to survive. So it drops down onto the ground, and then it does something very deceptive. It makes the noise of a queen ant. So it imitates the noise of a queen ant and tricks the caterpillar into picking it up and taking it into the nest, because it thinks that the queen has come out of the nest. And it also creates makes a pheromone, the smell of a queen ant, which is just crazy. So then this caterpillar is taken into the security of the red ant's nest. And then it turns really bad. It goes from being a herbivore to a carnivore, and it starts to eat all of the brood of the ants. Oh, and the ants are tricked into looking after it. And it stays in there until it becomes an enormous, great big pupa and hatches out into a large blue butterfly and flies away. So it's an amazing story.
That is absolutely incredible. And I think I've become a bit of a large blue butterfly fan following that. I didn't realise quite how intelligent that they were. One thing I wanted to ask you is, obviously, you had quite the narrator for the documentary. What was it like when you found out Sir David Attenborough had come on board for the project?
It was amazing. And, it, you know, of course it added so much to the project. We have been work. Silverback Films works with him quite a lot, so we do know him, and we've been telling him about the project. Myself and Alistair Fothergill made a trip to see him to tell him more about it and ask him whether he might narrate it. So we turned up with a promo with some of the footage we'd shot, and we took a lemon drizzle cake, which was our secret weapon, and he was just really bowled over and actually thanked us for coming to him and said, you know, I'm so grateful that you've come to me. And we were, wow, you know. So he agreed to do the narration. And then a little while later, after a year or so, we felt it would be much more powerful to see him in vision. And he had so many stories to tell. Having reached the grand age of 96, he had seen so much change in Britain's wildlife and the environment. So it was a powerful story to have him talking to camera at the top of each programme about how things had changed in his lifetime.
I do think that is something that really struck me, actually, when watching the documentary. Just that idea of changing baseline. So what he was used to when he was a child, to me, I would look at that and think, wow, that is a phenomenal abundance of wildlife. And it's quite terrifying, actually, to think when, you know, like my grandchildren's age group, what their standard of wildlife will be. Will it be worse than what we have now, and will they look back on this and think that's incredible, or will they have, you know, hopefully gone the other route and have a restored wildlife? It's a bit mind-blowing, I think, to think
it
about.
It is, and I think Wild Ours is a moment in time, so we've captured what we have in 2023. But even for me, being in the middle, I used to worry a bit about walking through meadows because you'd get grasshoppers and all kinds of insects in your hair and in your clothes. And it's not like that anymore. And as you say, there's a different norm. There's a new norm for people nowadays, and they don't know what they've lost. So I'm hoping, and in the last programme, David Attenborough says, let's hope we can leave these isles and the wildlife in a better position than we found it. So it would be very nice if the future generations could inherit more wildlife. And that's what we've got to do, because it's not good enough. And it's sad that what they're seeing now is so diminished.
Yeah, that was actually, I think, probably my favourite quote of the documentary, when he said about perhaps your generation could be the first to leave it in a better state than you received it. And actually, I think you did a great message of encouraging people to get out there with wildlife and to try and help protect and restore it, which is more so needed than ever. But was it quite a challenge to get that balance right of, I guess, celebrating the wildlife that we have and giving people hope, but also very much letting them know how severe the situation really is?
Yeah, it's a real challenge, and it is a real balance. I think what we wanted to do was to inspire people, make them feel excited and make them feel proud of the wildlife that they have so that they care. But at the same time, it felt dishonest to portray this as a wonderful Disney-like world that was out there. So we tried to contextualise things. So, for example, we would give things a sense of value. So with chalk streams, we'd say there are only just over 200 or so, and we've got 85% of them, which makes you think, wow, you know, that is quite incredible that this small set of islands has that many and it's that important. And similarly with things like bluebells, we've got 50% of the world's common bluebells, and we walk through them and take them for granted. So we wanted people to value what they have and think that the British Isles was special. But equally, we needed to give them the message that it was fragile and that we do need to do something about it. So we didn't want doom and gloom. We wanted reality. And we were lucky enough to be working with RSPB and WWF and Open University and other wildlife trusts that would then continue that message. So they could be a little bit, not harder, but a bit more down to earth about the message of conservation and feed in more facts and offer solutions, things that people could do to help. So I kind of think British Isles is Wild Isles was a bit of a springboard for that, to get people a bit worried.
And I do think it has helped, you know, start that wildlife conversation, and hopefully it will inspire people to really make a difference. And it's nice that it showcases our wildlife, because then you've got something to fight for, haven't you, and to try and restore as well. And I think that your messaging was really powerful. But I wanted to ask, what would you, if anyone had a one take-home message, what would it be for this documentary? What would you most like people to take from it?
I'd like them to be proud. I'd like them to be excited and inspired by wildlife. I'd like them to care. But equally, I'd like them to understand that it's fragile and do something about it. You know, do what you can and try and help that message, that last message, come true, so that we head in the other direction. We head towards having more wildlife and more wild spaces.
Yeah. Throughout the series, I imagine that you met quite a few conservation heroes. Are there any that particularly stood out to you?
Well, we met some amazing scientists and wardens, so too many people to mention, but I did meet one really lovely lady called Hazel Ryan. And she is. She works for Wildwood, and she was an expert in dormice. So she helped us to set up cameras, and her sort of knowledge of dormice and her dedication was incredible. And she's involved with a scheme where they are breeding dormice for re-release. They have hundreds of dormouse boxes in a woodland, and her and her colleagues spent hours checking them and just taking data. So I take my hat off to them in the wet woodlands, bringing all this data together. And working with her was really eye-opening. And we shared footage of what was happening inside the nest boxes, because we had infrared cameras and they don't usually get to see that because it's so sensitive. So it's people like that who just put in extra effort and just are so dedicated. So that would be my mention of the day.
Oh, brilliant. They're always such an inspiration, I think, people like that. And it paid off because you got unbelievable dormouse footage. It was really lovely watching that throughout the series. One episode that I think deserves a particular mention is the Saving Our Wild Owls episode, because that has some real messaging about how we can all sort of help. What would you like people to take from that episode?
Well, it's a complimentary programme which goes into some of the issues in more detail. So it's an opportunity to see people that are engaged in projects and making a difference, from planting trees to planting seagrass and just urban projects as well. So I think the message to take home from that is that there is hope, there are people doing fantastic projects, and there are things that you can get involved with as well.
And I think one take home thing is, sometimes we think we have to donate money to help wildlife, but actually donating your time, getting involved with things like that can be brilliant. And I wanted to ask, for sort of the everyday person, do you have any tips on what we can all do to sort of go that step further to helping our wildlife?
Well, I think it's a win-win, really, getting involved, because it's so good mentally and physically just to be in contact with nature. We get very disconnected. And there are quite simple things you can do, from just planting bee-friendly plants in your garden, if you have a garden. If you don't, if you've got a window box planting flowers, maybe not mowing your grass in May and leaving some wild areas for insects. And then you can get involved with charities and organisations. You could plant some trees. So there's lots of things that you can do. Even thinking about your diet and how you travel will have its own impact. So perhaps if you're a meat eater, cut down on eating meat. It's kind of environmentally expensive to produce. and do more walking. Think about your journeys. So lots of very simple things that you can do.
Definitely. And I think a great place for people to start, if they're not quite sure, is if you go to the Saving Our Wild Owls website or on the Essex Wildlife Trust website, we have an actions page, and it's a great place to start if you're not quite sure how to go about getting involved in helping the nature that we have. Now, I wanted to ask you a bit of a fun question, because I like to ask all my guests. What is your coolest wildlife fact?
Well, apart from the toads, toadlets, seeing that was incredible. But I think I was surprised to find that we have one of the biggest birds of prey in the world in England, in Britain. So in Scotland, we have white-tailed eagles that are very big. So they have a wingspan which can be up to 2.45 metres, which is huge. You know, if you imagine stretching those wings out, they're as about 8 feet, 7 or 8 feet, as long as a car. So to think of having a bird of prey in our skies that's that big, I thought was quite amazing.
Oh my goodness, I didn't realise they were that big. They, I think, are going to have to go on my wildlife bucket list now that I've heard that fact. Unfortunately, that's all we've got time for, but I just wanted to thank you so much for taking your time out to talk with me today, and well done on such a fabulous documentary. I think it's the messaging is powerful, it's just beautifully done. So thank you very much. I've really enjoyed it.
Thank you very much.
How about that? What an honour to speak to Hilary, such an interesting woman, and how great to be able to learn a bit more about what goes into the making of these phenomenal wildlife documentaries that we all know and love. Thank you so much for listening. It really does mean a lot to us all at the Trust. If you would like to support us further, please do subscribe to the podcast, leave a rating, or share with your friends. That's all for now. See you next time.